Okay, well, I changed the title a little bit. Yeah, right. So, I mean, the thing I want to say is that, I mean, all this is joint work with Oliver Diaz, who is in the audience, and I will try to describe what we have done. So this is an old problem, which is how the how these systems are affected by you have the one-dimensional systems, and then you modify them by noise, and then try to see if there is an effective description of the noise. So roughly speaking, we will be considering models of this type. I mean, this is a dynamical system, and then you put noises. The properties of the noise can depend on the position a little bit, and then of course on a random variable, and then I have this free adjustable coupling constant, etc. So, for example, at the moment we will be discussing one-dimensional maps, and then they can be several things like unimodal maps, diffeomorphisms of the circles, or analytic points of these things over here. So the important point about these noises is that they are all of them independent. So, I mean, if you freeze the variable X and then you consider them as random variables, then they are all going to be independent when you change N. Okay? So when you change X, then I don't claim anything. So then you can write, of course, you look at the iterates, you keep on iterating this, and I will just write xn, depends on, of course, on the initial condition, the noise level, and of course, it's a random variable, it depends on the random realization of all the noises that you have, right? And so what we are interested in obtaining is the distribution of xn when you take large n and small sigma. And you do this in a control way, and then you try to understand whether there is a limit of these type of things. So this is the type of thing. So basically this is, you let your system, you take very, very weak noise, then you let your system run for a fairly long time, and then you repeat the experiment, and then you try to see what happens. So roughly speaking, the things that we will prove are sort of like this. I mean, I will just try, I mean, the things I will do in the next hour is try to fill in this green part over here, which is that there are some hypotheses on the system and on the initial condition, and then this is what I said, that if you take if you consider the noises which are sufficiently weak, and this is the thing that goes over here, if you take the noises which are sufficiently weak, when you look at the noises, and this depends on the number of iterates, right? You take the noises sufficiently weak, depending on the number of iterates, when you look at them, when you look at the distribution of the points, then this, and you take n sufficiently large, this is the usual normalization that you do so that it converges to a Gaussian, right? So, again, there is two assumptions, which is that the noises are getting weaker as the number of iterates grows, and we have kind of explicit formulas for the sigma, and they kind of are like what you expect in some statistical mechanics things. And so basically this is the way that you do it. So you take very, very weak noises, and the noises, and then the rescale distribution looks like a Gaussian. So the heuristic idea for this type of things comes from, I mean, for the people that are not from, that have a background in statistical mechanics, this is exactly like what you would do in scaling limits. So you are, the idea is that when you have these systems and the hypothesis that we are interested, like accumulation of period doubling or these things, is that these systems are, so to speak, are at a phase transition, they are at the border of chaos, and then what you do is precisely what people do in scaling limits. You consider the fluctuations of a very large domain, and then they start looking like free fields or something like that. So this is the for the people that are in the whatever, then it's all these things over here. So what I need to do next to explain you is what I explained by these undefined terms. What are the type of hypotheses on F and X0? And roughly speaking, I have already given a hint, is that the system is kind of in the border between chaos and these things, so that it can have so the systems. So one very easy example is when f of x, this is a silly example where the things work, which is when f of x is just the identity, and the sigma n's are of course identically distributed, they don't depend on x. When you look at this xn, it's just the initial value plus the sum of all these things, and then of course the statement that I was mentioning works over here, and then this is just the classical central limit theorem. And there are no conditions on sigma because the system is linear. So let me counterimpose this example with another example, which is that you take just a map, for example, a map of the circle, which is an expanding map of the circle, right? Then it's very easy to check that when you look at the nth part, and then, well, for example, you start in the initial point just to make life a little bit easy. So when you look at xn, then xn is just this hyperbolic sum. And when you look at this type of things, you look at the variance is also growing exponentially fast. When you when you sort of scale everything, whatever, then xn divided by its variance is just the sum, and then you see that this sum doesn't satisfy the central limit theorem. Okay, so some hypotheses are needed. When you take things that are the identity, the result is is very well known. When you take things that are growing, when you take orbits that are growing, that the derivatives are growing exponentially fast, the result is false. So, for example, I mean, this explains why these theorems are a little bit different from the usual theorems that you get into hyperbolic systems. I mean, this is a whole industry that was started maybe with the thesis of Marina Ratner, and then there are many, many recent developments by many, many people, some of them in the audience, so I will not mention. But when you take hyperbolic systems, then you take the initial condition kind of as a random variables, there is no standard noise, and then you obtain that the distribution of the final point is a Gaussian or something like that, right? In this case over here is kind of the opposite situation, okay? This is the effect of the noise, and then these results are going to be false for hyperbolic systems. So it's different scalings, and the different scalings and the different initial conditions, and then the proofs are going to be very different, and you see the hypotheses are very different, right? So these are central limit theorems are very different from the central limit. So this is another remark. So so the hypotheses that we will make about the function are, as I mentioned before, are like a phase transition. So you want to get something which is between hyperbolic and to make it a little bit more interesting, we want that it's a little bit more complicated than the identity. And then, of course, so what we want is systems in which the derivatives grow, but they grow like parabolically or like a power, etc. So that's more or less what is going to, I mean, I will make the definition a little bit, things over here. And so there are two examples that I will discuss. One is the accumulation of period doubling, and X is the basin of the attractor, and F is a map of the circle with golden rotation, and X0 is any point. So map means, for example, critical circle maps. So, for example, if you get into this theorem, you can fill in now the hypothesis so that you can say that, for example, if F is at the accumulation, if F is a point at the accumulation of, if F is one of the points at the accumulation of the period doubling, and X0 is a point in the basin of the attractor, then there is a, this result holds. Okay. Now, for example, if you look, for example, at the points at the accumulation of period doubling, you know that there are periodic orbits of period 2 to the n, and they are unstable, so the result is false for the orbit. So you have these central limit theorems depending on the initial conditions, and it holds if and only if you are outside of the unstable periodic orbits. So that's the situation. So this is if and only if. If you are if you are in the periodic orbit, the result is false, or the conclusions are false, And if you are in the basin of attractor, which is the rest, then the result, the conclusions are true, and you have a central limit theorem. So these are some numerics. For example, you just take, I mean, I don't remember. So this is done in the, for example, this is a histogram of the of whatever it is, taking 2 to the 14 iterations for the golden mean. So with 5, 10 to the minus 11, take the initial point, and then this is with equally distributed noise, with uniformly distributed noise, and then this looks like a Gaussian. And for the people that know statistics, this is the Kolmogorov-Smirnov plot or something, so that the statisticians call QQ plot for the Gaussians. But this is a test. So the Kolmogorov-Smirnov theory tells you that it is a Gaussian if and only if all these points appear in the diagonal, and then this looks pretty good. So so this is the, let me just try to sort of the things over here. So the hypothesis that are over there, I mean, I just stated it over here. So if F is a infinity unimodal map, quadratic at zero at the accumulation of period doubling, and x0 belongs to the basin of the attractor, you need a little bit of regularity, like three moments, which are of course not an assumption if you take things that have compact support. I mean, you need a little bit, and then the sigma n's. And in this case, we can be very explicit about what you need by the sigma n's, so these are going down like a power. All right, and of course, I mean, the same result appears, similar analysis applies to other renormalization fixed points, and I am not going to go into this detail. I mean, for example, you can assume that you have a quartic renormalization, or I mean, the fixed point is not quadratic. The fixed point could be a quartic order or a seventh order, or etc., or that for circle maps. So, I mean, this is what we are here, and the main tool to prove these things is the analysis of renormalization, and it's a process very similar to what Marco was describing. You kind of try to zoom in, and then these zooming ins are described by renormalization. So that's what we will try to do. So there is this renormalization of noise, which is extremely similar to this block spin renormalizations that was introduced by Leo Kadanoff, etc., and many other people in statistical mechanics, so it has kind of a flavor. I mean, of course, if I mean, the heuristic ideas come from statistical mechanics, and of course, the mathematical theorems, you can write them straight, and this is the story. So you take the renormalization of noise, and I mean, it's worth pointing out that some non-rigorous renormalization of these noises for the period doubling was done by Crutchfield, Huberman, and Packard, and by Schreiman and Wayne and Martin, both of them in 1981. So let me try to start describing these things. So let me try to describe this heuristic renormalization, then I will make it rigorous, and then I will show you how there is a zooming in mechanism that allows you to reproduce the result that I stated by just understanding the renormalization, right? So for the moment, I will concentrate into sort of making sense of renormalization and then proving theorems about renormalization, and then try to see what is all this. So the idea of renormalization, which I will describe only for period doubling, is that you start from the system and then you perform an operation. You just they give you a system, and then you decide, I am going to look at it only half of the times, and then I am going to scale the variables, and if everything goes well, then the system that you obtain by decimating will look very similar to the system that you started with, or at least be more understandable, right? So two operations more or less at the same time, and one is of course looking at the system every other time, and the other is scale the space variables. So this is the heuristic theory, so I kind of use approximate, etc., right? And then later on I will have to use inequalities and other things, but for the moment let me try to use this approximating things, which is, this is the things, the way that the way that crutch fill, etc., wrote it, etc. So if you look at it every other time, this is what you have. You look at the system at time n plus 2, then it's f of x n plus 1 plus sigma, whatever I was putting over here. I'm not writing the random variable, but that's the situation over here. This is one time. And then you apply it another time, and this is an equality. So this is just substituting it two times. And now the thing that you try to do is, and here is where I use the where I use an approximation, and this is the approximate renormalization, is that you sort of just do a Taylor expansion of this part over here, okay? And then if you do a Taylor expansion, then you obtain the second iterate, and then this is just the derivative, and then apply it to this term, which is the increment, and then this other term that I just copied. So if you write xn to xn plus 1, so this is the approximate renormalization procedure, you have that the new map, which you obtain by looking at the variables lambda, yn, etc., so this is the renormalized map, and then the renormalized noise is all this expression that I have over here. Okay? So that's the, which is obtained just by doing exactly what I said, looking at the map every other time, and then I made this uncontrolled approximation. This is the heuristic part yet, and deriving the renormalization group theory. So there is this noise, and the thing that I want to sort of point out is what is the structure of this thing, this noise over here. So there is these random variables over here. They are evaluated at slightly different points, and then they are multiplied by coefficients. So this is very similar to these transfer operators that Vivian is an expert on. Sigma depends on, yes, okay, so I should be a little bit more careful with the notation. Over here, n is a, dummy variable. I mean, I was reusing the variables too much, maybe, but that's a very good point. I mean, at the end, I was trying to take n to be the final point, and then this is something that happens at all the intermediate steps. So maybe I should be using an I here rather than n. N is the final point, right? So when you get the final point, when you want to get the final point, then you need to get the I to be. No, well, this is what I was saying over here. I apologize. This is a bad notation that I was using. So what you want to do is you want to find a final noise, and then you rescale the noise at the beginning, and then you propagate it through. N is the final. This should be I, maybe this is a very good point, so let me just correct it. I, whatever it is, all right. So, and then, so you write I goes from 0 to n. And then sigma depends on n, but not on I. But this is the renormalization procedure, so. So you see this is sigma n, sigma, let's put over here, depends on n, but not on I, so I apologize, yeah? So sometimes you do this thing. So you try to do a big block, and then you make the big blocks. I mean, this is typical of these scaling limits. For each of the problems, you're going to do a finite number of renormalizations. For each of the models, and you take a finite number of renormalizations. So this is the plan of attack. So what I want to do is to, first of all, is to do a rigorous analysis of this transformation that I describe over here. I mean, I have derived this transformation from thin air. Well, not from thin air, but from the papers of very clever people 20 years ago, right? So you get this transformation, so what I want to do is to analyze it very carefully, and then when I analyze it carefully, then it will turn out that I can justify these Taylor expansions that went into the derivation, and then I can do this summing argument, etc., right? And then you get the theorem. Yes? So let me try to see how you can analyze this theorem. I mean, of course, the deterministic part is very well understood, is the usual renormalization, right? And now we have to sort of concentrate on this other thing, which was the renormalization of noise. Okay, now, the point that I want to sort of mention is that, as I said before, this is this renormalization of noise that I circled here it's a linear operator, so to speak, right? Because, I mean, you see the xis appear linearly, evaluated in different places and multiplied by coefficients, but it's a linear operator. So I am not trying to find fixed points, but I am trying to find the scaling relations, right? So when you try to do these things, so when you have linear operators, there is no point. I mean, I can tell you what is the fixed point, right? So that's not interesting, and this is what happens in the scaling limits. But I mean, by the way, if you look into the history of the problem, the original papers of Feigenbaum were written in the language of scaling limits, not in the language of fixed points. This came a little bit later. So, okay. So let me try to see what is the situation. An important tool in the analysis is something that the statisticians call cumulants, and then the physicists call the correlation functions or the weak order powers, and then there are these operators formally. So what I want to do is to, when they give you a random variable x, you define the cumulants of order n by this relation. You take the exponential, you take the expected values, and then you expand it in powers of n, and then there is this funny combinatorial factor, n factorial, which causes grief. But when you try to compare different books, some books put it, some books don't put it. So I just so this is the thing, and then this is formally. And if you want to sort of make things that converge, then you put an I there, and then there is an I. Rather than putting T, you put IT. So, for example, there are these magic. These are the expressions. So, they have names in statistics. For example, the third one is called the skewness, and the fourth one is called the kurtosis. And if you look into any statistics book and you look into the index, they have entries for these things, and they play a very important role. Two properties that are elementary and follow from these things over here, which we are going to be using quite a lot, is that when you multiply a variable, then the nth order thing over here works like if it was a power, right? So then it goes like a to the n, and then they are additive when you take independent variables. So when you take independent, this is very similar to the things that happen for the variance. You know that the variance of the sum of two independent variables is the sum of the variances. And now, I mean, this is a little bit of technology, but I mean, you will see that under some regularity properties, which I am not going to discuss a little bit, but I mean, roughly speaking, the thing that happens is the following. I mean, if you look at the cumulants and your Laplace transform of the density is analytic, right? Then what is going to happen is that if you know the derivatives, then you know what the function is, right? So knowledge of the cumulants gives you sort of approximation to what the function is going to be, right? And then there are other things that happen, like, for example, the fact that you have a Gaussian variable, you can estimate the fact that you have a Gaussian variable is basically connected to the fact that when you take the logarithm, all the derivatives are zero beyond the third, right? And then if you estimate the variables, then it always happens that the values of the moment at zero determine all the other parts of the cumulant, so that you can do that. So there are other more quantitative, and as I will mention a little bit, there are these type of things, like I will just try to sort of escape it. But the point is that if there is a technology which goes back to statistics and probability, so that if you have knowledge and estimates on the cumulants, you can sort of find out how close you are to the Gaussian, right? And in particular, these things have been in use in statistics for a very long time, so that people give them funny names like skewness and kurtosis and all that sort of things, right? So that you can estimate these things. So now let me just go back to this, try to use these cumulants to analyze my noises, etc. And then this is another thing of the mistakes that that Kostia was pointing out, that I am overusing the letter n. So n has nothing to do with the number of iterates here. So I should maybe use another letter. I mean, I don't know why I was doing this, but I apologize because so then maybe try to put over here. It's too late to change, but for these lectures, so take N to P or something like that. I think in the paper is right, no? Because over here, N has nothing to do with the number of iterates, it has to do with the order of the cumulants. Sorry about this. So nothing to do with N and these other things over here. So what I am going to start is to look at the cumulant of the random variable evaluated at X on these things here. So that's what I try to do. So if you take cumulants of the expression of the renormalized noise, this is what you obtain. If you take the so this is the renormalized noise is if you remember the expression, it was just the noise evaluated at a certain point over here, which is was F composed with lambda, the other place composed with lambda, and then combined with coefficients. Okay? Now you use this property of the cumulants that the cumulants when you sort of have independent variables, they just become additive. And when you multiply by a constant, then you multiply by a power, right? So there was the noise evaluated at this place, it goes through, plus the noise evaluated at another place, it goes also through, right? And then what you have is these powers, right? So these are the coefficients, but then I am raising them to the nth power, right? I am raising them to the nth power, and this is what you get. Okay, and now what I point out is that if you look at these variables k, which are the cumulants, etc., then this is a linear operator that goes from one to the other. So if you know the cumulant kn, you form this expression, and then you obtain the renormalized noise, the cumulant of the renormalized noise, right? So this is just translating the renormalization into properties of cumulants. And I point out that when you get the translation between cumulants, which of course depend on the position, you obtain a linear operator, which of course Vivian knows very well this type of operators, right? They are kind of transfer operators. They have the similar structure. You have one function evaluated at one point, one function evaluated at another slight transform points, and then you have these coefficients that appear here. Okay, so let me just try to say what happens, and of course several people in the audience know what is going to happen. Once you have these operators, if you look at the properties of the properties of the fixed point, this is F composed with lambda. So this you start with things that are defined in the unit interval, and then this gives you the values into two smaller places. These are the typical decimation things, etc., right? So these operators kn that give you the cumulants of the renormalized noise in functions of the cumulants of the unrenormalized noise, these operators are analyticity improving. Okay? So these operators are analyticity improving, and then they are also positivity preserving in this, well, when I should put over here when n is even, they are positivity preserving. It's obvious because you see this when n is even, the coefficients that multiply are positive, and the coefficients that multiply are positive, right? So if you start with a positive function, then they are positive. And now we are in this situation that you have compact operators. And they have, you have compact operators that preserve positivity, and there is a little bit of an extra property which I am not going to discuss, which is transitivity, which means that when you sort of take enough powers, the only way that you can have a function which doesn't mix, the argument is when they are zero, right? So this is the, so the conclusion that you obtain is that there exists a positive leading eigenvalue, which is simple, and then it has also a positive, strictly positive eigenvector, right? So this is the conclusion that you get. I mean, you have compact operators. So they work like, I mean, compact operators work more or less like matrices. And if you have a matrix that has all entries positive, that's the Perron-Frobenius theorem. For compact operators, then there is a little bit more of technology, and then sometimes it's called the Krein-Rudman theorem. but it works just as well. And the proof can be done more or less along the same lines. So there is a very important inequality that follows from this, and I will sort of try to tell it over here very quickly. So the proof is that there is this kind of convexity property. If you look at rho is the spectral radius, so when you take the spectral radius of the 2L cumulant, is smaller, is strictly smaller than the spectral radius of K2 to the Lth power. And maybe I should try to sort of, and the proof is not very difficult. The proof is that what you try to do is you take K2 applied, you know that there is a leading eigenvalue and that the leading eigenvalue is positive, right? So what you do is that you take the K2 to the L, right? The eigenvalue of 2, you raise it to the F power, okay? Then you feed it to the fourth, to the second order cumulant, and then you realize that there are certain terms that don't appear. In one case, you do the, you take the equation for the L, the equation for, sorry, you take the equation for the 2, you raise it to the L power, and you consider the equation for 2L, and you realize that one has more terms than the other, and all the terms are positive. Since the leading eigenfunctions are positive, then this raises the eigenvalue strictly by just a tiny amount. Okay? So this is the type of, I mean, should I give more details or? I mean, it's a very simple thing. So you see, the important thing is that if you look at K2, K2 has some power over here, so that this is A. Okay, so this is K2. Let me just try to say it over here. So you have this K2 of K2 is equal to, let me put over here, so that this is A, K of, you put all this here, this function, let me put it over here, G of X plus this is B, K2 of H of X. So this is, roughly speaking, the structure of these things over here. And you look at what is K2L of a function. Let me not put over here the letter. So this is just A to the L power, K to the G of X, and then B of K of H of X. So this is the structure of the things, and then there are these things that happen to the L power, right? So if you know that one of these operators is equal to, well, suppose that you have these things over here, let me just put over here 2, and then this is equal to rho 2 of K2, right? Suppose that you know that this is rho 2 to K2, right? Okay, now you take this equation over here, you raise it to the Lth power, right? And then you see that when you look at K2, and then you put over here K2, this is equal to lambda L and rho 2 K2 to the Lth power, okay? And then you put over here minus stuff, which is the thing that comes from the thing that happens on the other things over here, and then this minus is strictly negative. So what you have is you have a positive function in such a way that these things over here, so that you discover that the spectral radius, sorry, rho 2 to the L, so that you discover from the fact that the leading eigenfunction has to be positive, that this has to be strictly smaller, so that the leading eigenfunction has to be strictly smaller than this one. So that's the important inequality. So there is a little bit, so these things kind of scale, but there is a little bit of, and with a little bit more of extra work, you can do the same result for OL, etc. And now here is what happens. So if you look at the cumulant of the highly renormalized noise, it grows like the second order, like the second, like this rho 2 to the Lth power, and then something that depends on the distribution of noise, on the original distribution of noise. And then when you look at the other cumulants of the rescaled variable, when you rescale so that the variance becomes 1, right, And this is the way that you can more or less prove also the central limit theorem. If you rescale so that the second eigenvalue, the second cumulant remains constant, then all the other cumulants are going to sort of have to go to zero. Right? And this is because of all this, I mean, the other cumulants are growing with an eigenvalue, with the Lth eigenvalue, right? But the Lth eigenvalue, the scales, has a spectral radius smaller than the other one, right? So when you pull out the scaling factor by the scaling of the other cumulant and you look at what is the spectral radius of this, then you obtain that something that converges exponentially fast. I mean, this is also some ways in which people can prove the central limit theorem, the standard central limit theorem. You look at these other higher moments and that's what happens. So what is the conclusion? The conclusion is, well, the conclusion is the following. So this linear renormalization converges to a Gaussian, right? And you prove that by just checking that the cumulants, all the other cumulants decrease exponentially fast, right? And there's some properties, etc. And then, and now, once I know that the linear approximation converges to a Gaussian, I can use something which is very similar to the things that you use in differential equations, which is, I mean, once you have the first order equations, then this is something which is called the variational equations, and then you can estimate the rest of the things how the estimates, I mean, once you know the first order variational equations, the second order things become, you can estimate them using the second derivatives and so on. This is the way that typically people prove the shadowing theorem or things like that, right? So you do this, so you estimate this, and so then the linear part, so for weak enough noise, and this is where the conditions that I was telling you that sigma star n has to be sufficiently small, right? So the conditions that we need are precisely those that tell you that the linear approximation dominates the second order, the other order approximations, right? So here is where the conditions for sigma n come in. Okay, so what you obtain is that the true renormalization converges to a Gaussian. So what I mean by the true renormalization is when you include these terms that I was excluding from the Taylor expansion, right? I mean, when you exclude the Taylor expansion, all these things over here. And now here is where the zooming in argument, so this is where the zooming in argument comes in, and it's very similar to what Marco was describing. The thing is, well, suppose that they give you one number n. What you do is that you expand it in the binaries. You write its binary expansion. And then, well, let's look at what happens for the orbit of zero. So when you look at Fn, you can write it as the binary expansion, right? And now what you do is that, well, let's block the things. If you look at the renormalization, if you look at what is the effect of noise, well, the noise affects this part, the noise affects this other part, the noise affects all these other parts, right? And again, in first order, these things are going to be, well, it's just the 2 to the n 0 multiplied by a constant, right? Then the next block multiplied by the derivatives, right, at the end, etc., right? And now the interesting thing is that, of course, this is the heaviest one. This is the heaviest one because it contains 2 to the n 0. And so this is, if you take n sufficiently large, this has to be rather close to a Gaussian, and then all the others have to be close to a Gaussian, except maybe the first or the second, which have a very small weight anyway, right? So basically what you are doing is that you are, if you look at what is the effect of noise is the sum of several things that can be controlled by renormalization, and all of them are Gaussians. So then the final result is close to a Gaussian. So this is what you do for the orbit of zero. For and again, there is some terms which there is some terms over here that depend on sigma squared, but again, with the hypothesis that sigma is small enough, and that's where the hypothesis also come in, then you sort of discover that they don't matter. Right, so then you're winning. So basically, the main part is a sum of Gaussians. I mean, and you need to sort of check that you need to write the things in this way the way that Marco was writing them, so that the renormalization can go from one box to the next, etc. So you write it in this way and then things work. So this is how you prove that the orbit of zero satisfies this property, and then once you have this for the orbit of zero, you know that this is true for every point in the basin of attraction by an epsilon third argument. Of course, as you are getting close to the periodic orbits, the limit takes longer and longer to sort of manifest itself, and then when you are in the periodic orbits, then the conclusions are false. Right? So that's the situation that happens. So let me mention some final remarks. So some generalizations of this type of procedure, and then I will sort of, so I don't think that this is the end of the story, so we there are also some numerical simulations which remain unexplained, and this remains as a challenge to try to prove these things over here. So let me try to abstract these proofs a little bit. And so the important thing is the following. I mean, if you look at these things, what happens is that the things that sort of drive everything here is that the cumulants of noise, they propagate in different ways. Because, I mean, roughly speaking, when you do the linear approximation, then the noise becomes propagated by the derivative, right? So you think of noises as little things, and then you propagate them by the derivative. And when you are at the end, then you collect them. The ones that appear very far away have been affected by the derivatives, right? And when you look at different cumulants, then you are looking at powers of the derivatives along the whole orbit, right? But raised to different powers. And then if the system is, of course, if the derivatives were growing exponentially fast, then the sums of exponentials to a power is the same as the exponentials to a power up to some constant that I don't care of at the moment, right? But if you have things that are growing parabolically, raising things to a power makes a big difference when you sum. I mean, it's not the same of summing the powers than raising the powers to the sum, okay? For exponentials, it is true, but for parabolic things, it is not true, okay? And this is what's going on. So roughly speaking, the conditions that you want is that these type of things grow at different rates, and that the ratios go to zero. And this is true for parabolic things. And then these other things work also. You can do this type of arguments also for other renormalization groups, like the critical circle maps, and maybe other things like, you know, other, like what Ekman and Epstein were calling the peer renormalization, or maybe others, which I don't know really. Okay? Now, there are other things that are, I mean, once you have all this machinery, you have control over all the cumulants, and then you look into all these statistics and probability books, and then there are several things that one can try to do. You say, well, the main term of the convergence is the Gaussian, but then there are other things. If you look into to statistics and probability, then you can try to sort of ascertain what are the error terms for the Gaussian for in the central limit theorem, and then there are two types of errors. One are things that are called the very seen bounds, and then the Edgeworth expansions. So it turns out that all these things work out in this context over here. So the very seen tells you what is the errors of the distribution in the supremum sense, and the very seen tells you what and the Edgeworth expansions tells you what is the density. And the density is expanded in terms of the Gaussian plus the eigenfunctions of the harmonic oscillator, okay, plus error terms, etc., with coefficients. So you can get these things also for this context, but there is a surprise, which is that the form of the asymptotics is different. Because, for example, if you look into the Edgeworth expansions, you get that the main term is of order n to the 1/2, then the next term is order n to the minus 1, the next term is order n to the minus 3/2, etc. So now here you get different powers of n in the terms, and the powers of n depend on complicated properties of the renormalization group operator. There are powers, but then the powers are not the powers that are produced by the regular Edgeworth expansions, which I think can be explained a little bit, and so on. So, so for numerical experiments, let me try to tell you a little bit of what happens when you try to do numerical experiments. So there are some things that you can put in the computer so that you can study the linear theory, and then you can discuss with this how good is the linear theory, and then let me try to sort of tell. So this is kind of more or less under mathematical control. The last thing is kind of a shot in the dark, which I think is, you know, it's a challenge for mathematics. So the first thing is very simple. It's just over here what I plotted is this type of things, which is this ratio of lambdas. Let me try to say over here. So this is the kurtosis. Sorry? That's right. Well, I cannot claim any credit for this. I mean, it appeared already by in books by, you know, statisticians. No, in statistical mechanics, people call it the fourth weak order moment or something like that, or the fourth correlation function, which is even it's. Yeah, I mean, if you put over here, if you want to label a, if you want to label a figure and you put the fourth order, weak order moment, then it doesn't fit. So, no, I don't know. I mean, if you go into any statistical package and so on, and then you type in kurtosis, then there is a function that does it for you. So, to be honest, I think it was invented by some, I don't know who invented it, Fisher, I think. Ronald Fisher, Sir Ronald Fisher or something put the name, or maybe even earlier. Yeah, but it sounds like a disease, yes, I think. Okay, so this is the type of things that we put over here. So this is estimating, so this is trying to plot this influence of the kurtosis, so this is estimating these things over here. What we got from the renormalization group is that this thing is this is in a double logarithmic plot, so that this is decreasing like a power, and it has this kind of periodic corrections, which is, I mean, they are periodic in logarithmic scale, so this is something which still needs to be investigated. So this slope matches very well what our bounds say, right? I mean, of course, you know, bounds are bounds, and you can worry about whether the bounds are accurate or not. So these bounds are very accurate. Now, the periodic part requires a little bit of explanation. I think it can be done, maybe. And now there is something which is trying to sort of estimate what is the size of the error of the quadratic terms. So remember that we have this, so this is the sigma of the effective noise, this is the sigma of the effective noise, as a function of the sigma, of the or of the original sigma, right? And of course, we have been studying only the regime where this is linear, right? So you see that this is, and then we only have claimed that this looks like linear for sufficiently small, right? So the range of validity of, and of course we have bounds saying, well, this looks like linear for sigma sufficiently small, et cetera, et cetera. So you can check that there is, of course, you see that from here on it looks pretty linear, and from here on it doesn't look pretty linear. So the right limit of validity should be something like that, and that also more or less matches the bounds that we have. So then we are happy that the bounds are more or less over here. Now, here is something that... that you can, that it's kind of a shot in the dark, and I cannot claim to have an explanation. So I think that a good work should also have open questions, etc. So here is one thing, which is the Kolmogorov-Smirnov statistic, which measures how good, how close you are to a Gaussian, how close you are to a Gaussian. So the thing that is done over here is that you take a bunch of number of iterates, and then you take different noises, and then you see how far are the things to a Gaussian, right? So being close to a Gaussian means being a being around one, right? So roughly speaking, this is a Monte Carlo, so then it has numerical noise. So this has numerical noise. So basically, these things over here are close to a Gaussian within the numerical error, and then these things are not, and then this measures how close, how not close you are to a Gaussian, okay? So the theory that we have more or less matches this part over here of the plot, right? so matches the lower 20th of the plot, right? So we have a good theory about it. But then there is a very, I mean, if you try to eyeball it, there is a very curious fact, which is that if you translate these things, then they start looking like the same, right? So maybe there is, this suggests, but of course, you see, I mean, you look at this, how close they are to a Gaussian, and so roughly speaking, what this tells you is that the way that you converge to a Gaussian, which, I mean, we prove that there is some way that you converge to a Gaussian, etc., and then you converge to some things that are not a Gaussian in the middle, in this process, etc., but this process of convergence also has some so similar properties which so far have not been explored. Ah, yes, the distribution is always uniform. I should have said it, the noise is uniform noise.
I would think that this is not universal with respect to the
It's, that's right, it reproduces it well. We have not checked that, but I think it's easy to check. A good suggestion. So this is a shot in the dark, and I think, you know, I think that this field is being driven a little bit of by experiments, and you have to sort of, I mean, once you have a theory, I think it's very natural to sort of explore what are the limits, and then if there are some extrapolations. The good part is that this thing, and of course this thing over here is in pretty good control, and this seems to indicate that our bounds are pretty sharp. But there is this other part which. I have no idea, so. Okay, thank you.